Okay, last session of the day.
Appreciate everybody stay awake.
It's huge. To be honest, I'm surprised I'm still awake after all this.
Yeah, you'll get your chance. You guys can go out to 929 together. You know, big biochemistry boot camp party. Like I said, I'm going to go home and probably curl up in my room for a while. Let's see. I think it's PC. Okay. So our last session, again, doesn't have so much to do with computational tools, but some topics will come up on computation, and other topics, you know, just like with the safety stuff, I think it's, you know, it's good for people who are new to research to at least see some of this material. And we'll go over some things, and hopefully it'll still benefit you even if you've already been doing research for a while. You know, we're basically going to cover the standard stuff. What is a lab notebook? What I put in a lab notebook? Where it might become interesting is you know, a lot of the technology that we use, we generate data that doesn't necessarily lend itself all that well to writing in a lab notebook, or at least not in a traditional lab notebook. And so we'll go over some specifics on how, you know, I've thought about maintaining a lab notebook when the material is actually digitally written. And then finally we'll go over some my own example from a recent protein prep. And so the lab notebook itself, you know, it's your primary record of research. And so, you know, that doesn't, you take your lab notebook, I think, as seriously as you take your research, right? And so if you don't take your research seriously, then you just come in and you're playing around, and maybe you get a good result every once in a while, and you write it down. And then, you know, but then your advisor or somebody else can come in, and they can really see what kind of rigor that led up to that discussion or that discovery. And for me, I mean, I try not to be, and nobody wants to be a jerk about it, but I do try to look at the student's lab notebook, and it's the primary way that I assess how that particular student is developing as a scientist. And if they're making a very, you know, outlandish or you know, potentially earth-shattering discovery, the first place I'm going to go is their lab notebook and see, well, you know, what kind of rigor led up to this. And so I do use the lab notebook, you know, as this primary record, because I can't be in the lab all the time. I can't, you know, keep my eyes on the student's shoulders or looking over their shoulders the whole time. Most of my students wouldn't want that anyway. But if the lab notebook is there and it's in good shape, it's very easy for me to go back and say, yeah, no, this looks like it could be real. You know, if it's really crazy, I might say, well, we got to reproduce this a few times to make sure. But you know, sort of the lab notebook is sort of how you get your street cred as far as a researcher. Because, again, the rest of the world isn't going to be looking over your shoulder while you're recording your data. It obviously contains some background. It contains all of your methods and as much of your data as practical. And then it also should contain something on the interpretation of your results, too. So, for example, if you're doing an enzyme study and you make a mutation, and now you see that you've knocked down the catalytic rate of your enzyme by a factor of 10, you know, you should have something in there about, okay, well, then clearly this residue is important that I mutated. Could it possibly be making a hydrogen bond or stabilizing some kind of on-pathway intermediate? It's good to have those things in there. Maybe some, not so much in a research setting, but certainly if you know, you're ever trying to patent something and you want to say, I came up with this idea first, that kind of documentation, your interpretation, is important as far as providing proof of you know, that you were the first person to do this. You know, and ultimately, you know, what I really care about for my students is it needs to contain enough information that, you know, when you leave, or when whatever student leaves and graduates and hopefully goes on to bigger and better things, somebody else, either me or one of the future students, can come in, they can read the lab notebook, and they can pick up right where you left off. And if they can't do that, then that's going to frustrate me as an advisor. I'm sure it would frustrate your research advisors as well. Because again, I can't be everywhere. I can't be doing everything at the same time. I need to trust the personnel that are working in the lab to be doing high quality work and documenting the work in such a way that the next person can come on and continue the project. And so things to include in a lab notebook, again, a lot of these are self-evident. You know, you want to have, if you can, a table of contents. Maybe you don't document every single day that you're in the lab, but if there's an important date, you know, that, or if you do a protein prep or a mutagenesis experiment or some kind of cloning for the first time, and you're going to be using that method, you know, over and over again, it's probably a lot easier to have a table of contents and say, hey, look, page 53 has my molecular biology cloning protocol. And that way you're not constantly, oh, okay, what date was that? You know, oh, I know it was somewhere in the 50s. It's nice not to have to do that. And so a lot of lab notebooks today will give you a table of contents page or several pages. You can use that to document sort of the important milestones in your project. Title, you know, all experiments, you know, a procedure definitely. Ideally, you know, list of reagents used. Something that a lot of students don't realize, but sometimes it matters where you get your compounds, right? I mean, most of the time, if you go to Sigma and you pay $150 for 50 grams of sodium chloride, or you go to VWR and you pay $15 for 50 grams of sodium chloride, usually doesn't make a difference. And so a lot of our chemicals tend to come from VWR. On the other hand, you know, some specific chemicals, like if you're using some kind of particular reagent for synthesis, or you're trying to modify your protein chemically in some way, you know, it might be very important. You know, some organizations or some industry or company might purify their compound in such a way that those residual impurities might be very bad, and other companies might do it differently. And so, you know, think about, you know, do I have to write down the you know, the manufacturer and the part number or the supply number if I'm giving the list of reagents. It never hurts to write more. It takes a little bit more time, but think of that as an investment. If you spend, you know, 1 minute going to the Sigma website or going to the manufacturer's website, and it takes you 1 minute to write down the catalog number of the compound, that's a small price to pay. If, you know, the next time you come back to work from the lab, start doing that experiment 6 months later, somebody else used up the reagent, you can't remember where you got it from, and now you're spending, you know, 6 months trying to work with a different reagent that came from a different supplier that's not giving you the same result. And so, you know, stitch in time stays nine, I think, is the overarching theme of this whole presentation. List of instruments that you were used. You know, particularly if there's multiples. You know, suppose you have multiple spec 20s and you're measuring the optical densities of cells. You know, probably a good idea to write down, you know, I use the middle one. You know, and then if over time you find that the middle one gives the exact same results as the one on the right and left, great. But, you know, if you might find that the middle one always gives you the most consistent results, and so that's the one you want to keep using. A printout of data. You know, if you have data that are there, you might not be able to put every piece of data into your lab notebook, but it's nice to have some representative printouts, at least to show that you're making progress or getting results that corroborate what you say. You know, protocols, regular things that you're copying from the literature, calculations that you do. Sometimes you get to a conclusion, but in real research, it's you know, research isn't an ongoing thing. And so it's unlike an undergraduate lab where you reach a stopping point and say, okay, I'm done. Maybe at the end of your, you know, PhD or master's thesis, you can write a conclusion page. But most of the time, you focus on the data and the ongoing work. For maintenance, you know, all the data goes in the lab notebook. You know, if you have a day where, you know, heaven forbid, you come in, you're a little hungover, and the whole morning you collect crappy data, that doesn't mean that you just get to tear that page out of your lab notebook. Even if it's bad, you can always cross it out and say, hey, this, you don't have to write that you were hungover, and say, for whatever reason, I wasn't thinking straight this day, and this data turns out to be no good. You know, even if you spill something on the page, you basically just got to suck it up and deal with it. It's a good idea to be careful and not have lots and lots of open chemicals sitting around your lab notebook. You generally don't skip pages, although I've certainly done it, and I usually just say, look, I forgot to write on this page, or if I turn two pages instead of one. But it just makes it your life a lot easier if there's not a lot of skipped pages. And then if there's unused parts of the page, you just cross it out. Like, you don't want to make somebody think, well, why did they leave that blank? Or they're hoping to come back later and write something in that they forgot to. You want to correct mistakes. And so it's not like, you know, it's not like once you reach page 15, you can never go back to page 10. You know, if you reach page 15 and you realize, oh, my entire thinking was wrong for the first 15 pages of this lab notebook, go back to that first page and say, you know, note, see page 15, thinking incorrect here, or something along those lines. It helps you, like, if again, particularly the next person, they don't have to make all those mistakes if you're clear that, oh, no, this was wrong, see this next page instead, or see this alternative section instead. You know, I'm not going to go into honesty. I mean, honesty, for me, particularly in a research setting, I mean, you know, in some sense, if you're in a class and you cheat an exam, there is a real element of truth to the statement that you're only hurting yourself. But when it's in my lab, and it's research that I'm ultimately going to sign my name on, and I think probably most research advisors are of the same philosophy, I have zero tolerance policy on scientific ethics. And so, you know, honesty is an essential part of your lab notebook. You write down what happens, you don't fudge data, you don't make numbers up. You know, if something is fishy, you're forthcoming about it. You say, okay, well, this doesn't seem to be working, you've got to think about it. It's not like it has to be a perfect record where there's no flaws in it. But the flaws that are there should be, you know, documented, and they should be, you know, you should say that, hey, you know, this wasn't correct, don't know why, still working on it. But we'll get back to you later. You know, even if it's something really simple like that. Again, at the end of the day, we want our research to be published. And while it's true that as a primary author or a first author of a publication, you know, if that data is later found to be fraudulent, it comes back primarily on you. But it also comes back on the advisor itself. And there's a case. One of my friends was involved in it. He wasn't even in the lab when the fraudulent stuff happened. Or it wasn't even fraud. It was just bad biochemical technique. And it was a lab at UNC, and he basically signed on to come there as a postdoc basically a month before this, you know, bad data caused that particular lab to have to retract something like 6 papers. And it wasn't even fraudulent. It was they thought they were looking at something, at some kind of, you know, they thought they had designed a new enzyme, and it turns out that their purification was actually co-purifying some of the bacteria's own native enzyme that was doing the same thing. So, there wasn't, you know, dishonesty there. It was, you know, arguably they should have been more careful in their purification and lab techniques. But basically, that caused, you know, my buddy Dan, you know, he even published papers in this lab, but nobody was willing to take him seriously because the previous generation of postdocs had done a whole bunch of science that turned out to be shoddy. And so the repercussions of, you know, not even just fraud, but just, you know, not carelessness, are far more reaching than the individual who is directly responsible. And because of that, again, universities often have things like honor codes and honor boards and things like that. I'm not bound, and most advisors are not bound by the university's honor code when it comes to who works in the lab. You know, I may not be able to kick a student out of the university, but I can absolutely say, okay, sorry, you're not in the lab anymore. And I've never had to do it, I hope never have to do it, but it does emphasize the fact that even though this is an ethics lecture, honesty in your lab notebook is absolutely essential. And so, you know, just be forthcoming. Making mistakes is fine, but you can't ever be dishonest. And so how do you correct mistakes in a lab notebook? Well, the bad thing to do would be to sort of like scribble everything out so that there's no possibility that you can read what's going on under there. You know, even if you write down, like, oh, I misread the A2A value, you might come back and you might say, well, maybe I actually did the right thing. Maybe I didn't misread it. Maybe the first value was actually the correct value. Well, if you scribble it out and there's no way you can read it, there's no way that you can go back and you know, undo your mistake, so to speak. And so usually, you know, at the very least, you can cross it out. I might just draw straight lines, again, through it, hash marks, as long as you can still sort of read it underneath it. It doesn't have to be easy to read, but you don't want to go through with a Sharpie and start redacting parts of your lab notebook. That looks pretty bad. And so just, you know, use your pen, make some marks, and that way, now you know not only what your original value was, but what happened. You generally record your lab notebook into your lab notebook directly in ink. You know, this was such an issue that the U.S. spent, you know, I don't know about, they spent a lot of money to develop a fountain pen that would write in space. And so when there's zero gravity, the gravity that, you know, causes the ink to go down to the ballpoint pen is not present. And so a fountain pen will not generally work in space. And the U.S. spent a lot of money to figure out how to get it to work in space. Now, interestingly, the Russians had the same problem when they were doing their space program. They just used pencil. And arguably, a pencil might have been the better choice there. But generally, since we're here in real gravity, you want to write in ink, because ink can't be erased, generally. And, you know, it actually holds up a little bit better than pencil. You don't have to worry about coming back in 10 years and seeing all your ink is faded. You generally want to make marks only in the designated sections of your lab notebook. We'll see what that means here in a couple of minutes. You know, if there's not a numbered page, don't use it, or if you skip, you know, if you have to manually number your lab notebook and you accidentally skip a section, you know, don't just go back in and fill that in later. Because again, you want to be able to say, okay, go back to page whatever and refer to what I did there. So even if you have to use like, oh, I skipped from 26 to 28, or I skipped from 26 to 27 and there's two extra pages in there, you might even say something like 26A, 26B. Just give them a number so that you can actually use those pages. And then attach supporting information. I mean, you're not going to do all your graphs. You want to have it in the lab notebook as supporting information that's either taped in or stapled in. I prefer tape, but that's just me. One thing to think about that again, you guys might not normally think about, but particularly in a biological setting, we're often using things like ethanol, acetone occasionally. I mean, we don't usually work with the crazy solvents, but the solvents that we do work with are usually some of the same solvents or similar solvents to what's actually in ink. And so what I did for you know, this is Colin Purrington's idea, but I think it's kind of cool, where he basically tested a whole bunch of pens and a whole bunch of different types of you know, marking approaches. Everything from, you know, just trying a simple eraser to suppose you spill water on your lab notebook, methanol, ethanol, acetone. So I guess if you forget to leave it out of the autoclave. But he basically, you know, characterized what happens to each of those types of writing implements. And so we can do a simplified version of that test here.
again, I'm not going to take up a whole lot of time on this, but I think it's fun to have a little demo every once in a while.
I don't understand, like, the pencil that he has, the Dixon on the ribbon, it doesn't erase, I guess.
Yeah, that's a good point. I don't know about that. Maybe he didn't really try. Maybe he said, of course it's going to erase. So, yeah, I never noticed that before.
I mean, it can just be like a pencil that, I don't know.
Okay, so we got our Sharpie here. I'm gonna make a few marks just so it has something to focus on. And then I'm going to turn autofocus off. Okay. So, Sharpie. We've got some highlighter. You know, occasionally maybe you have a paper that you've marked up and that's sitting next to your paper or your lab notebook. You know, I have some grease pencil. So this is what I use to mark up all my glassware to make sure it doesn't end up in other labs. You've all seen these types of pens before, these lab markers. They're great, but they're not cheap, sadly. And, you know, I've got a standard, this is a gel pen. I don't really use gel pens because, as you can see, I'm left-handed, and most gel pens, I don't know, probably just how I learned to write. But you can see that the gel pens don't always work well for me. Pencil. Let's see, what else? We got my standard, good old standby. I love these pens. So this is my favorite pen by far, but I don't think it performs very well here. It's the Easy Touch, my Pilot. And then these are the generic pens that our department buys.
There's more pens you should try. These are my four favorite pens.
Okay.
They're great.
I'm not going to generally take requests, but we'll do this for a special case. So these are Flora's four favorite pens for the recording.
I'll try not to press too hard. So this is a felt tip here. Man, how do you, I mean, I think I would crush this the first time I used it.
I have a very light touch.
Obviously. Because this tip would last about an hour, and then I'd be looking for a new one. So this is a... This is a Uniball, and this looks like another felt tip, yeah.
I had carpal tunnel, so it kind of forced me to...
I guess that's a good excuse. Okay, so we've drawn some lines here. I'll give these back to Flora. And so, now again, a lot of the you know, material in pen ink is the same kind of material that's used to dissolve, you know, stuff and sterilize. And so, you know, apolar type solvents or polar aprotic solvents like acetone, which is a good buffer, or not a good buffer, it's a horrible buffer, but is a good solvent, generally doesn't necessarily work all that well. And so we're just going to, acetone also has a very, or is very volatile, and so it doesn't take much to get it to spray all over the place because of the vapor pressure inside the material. But you can see already this last one, your thick felt tip. Well, the Uniball was here. I don't think I've touched that one yet. Let's try to drip a few drops. Okay, so there's that first round. So these last four were yours, so they're actually not bad. The Uniball was here, that holds up pretty well. My Pilot Easy Touch and the departmental's generic pens both did pretty poorly, which is sad, but yeah, so be it. Sharpie blurred quite a bit. Interestingly, the Sharpie highlighter I gotta get that acetone out of here. I'm gonna pass out. Sharpie highlighter is fine. And you know, lab pen. You know, this was lab pen. That's pretty horrible. And like I said, the gel pen does pretty well. I'm not a big fan of the gel pen, but it seems like that's the best one. Obviously, pencil's not soluble, you know, graphite, but unfortunately, most ballpoint pens that you find will dissolve in organic solvent. And so we can sort of try this the next round with our ethanol. So this is like, I believe this is 200 proof. And so this will cover the rest of it. And so you can see, again, it's pretty abysmal. Although fluorous felt tips, I don't know, that's pretty incredible. I've never seen a felt tip behave like that. So so apparently if you want to buy pens and you don't mind having the lightest touch on earth, you can talk to Flora and figure it out. It's not uncommon, just like, you know, Matt said, I don't think that any of these compounds, you know, water's fine, most things will stand up to water, but it's not uncommon for you to have an ethanol squirt bottle at your bench. Frequently, you'll end up, you know, squirting down the bench, waiting 30 seconds and wiping it down to sort of sterilize your work area. And if you spill it on your lab notebook, well, now you can sort of see what the results are going to be. So it's... something to sort of keep an eye out for. You know, I'm not saying you have to switch pen manufacturers. You know, I love this type of pen, so there's nothing you're going to do to make me change. But it does mean that if I have my lab notebook open and I'm squirting ethanol at the same time, I'm going to be extra careful so I don't spill it. Okay, so journal references, again, we don't do research in a vacuum, and so oftentimes you're going to be looking at other people's protocols. You know, you need to have enough information. If you're going to cite somebody's protocol directly, you need to have enough information that, you know, the next person can come and find out what you're talking about. This is not, you know, this doesn't have to be this way. You know, you can write your references however you want. But if you write it this way, there's never going to be any doubt where to find it. Probably the bare minimum is going to be your journal volume number and first page. But it helps to have the year, just like we talked about NCBI websites yesterday. You can search by year. It helps to have an author name because it's nice to know whose work you're using. Generally, I find that I don't just cite the journal. Yeah, I'll put a few notes about what I'm doing from the journal. Or at the worst case, maybe not the worst case, but I'll just, you know, photocopy that page, cut it out, and tape it in. And that way you don't have to type it, I can just go look right there. Calculations, again, you don't have to do like, it's not like solving algebra and you have to put every single step. But you have to put enough step that you can sort of go back later and say, did I do this right? You know, if I'm making a pretty complicated buffer, and I have like 15 C1 V1 equals C2 V2 calculations, and you'll see that in the example that we look at, I'm not going to go and write every single one of those down. But I'll put enough information about my stock solution and what I added so that I can go back later, and if I say, oh look, I added 20 milliliters of heat buffer, I was only supposed to add 2. I can at least have an explanation about why my sample's not working properly. But you know, and even, you know, even as a faculty member, you'll see in my notebook, I put stuff like this. You know, one, I'm not in the lab enough that I feel like I can take shortcuts. I wish I could get in the lab more, but you know, this time here that we're gonna look at was the first time I'd done a protein prep in like 5 years. So I had to sort of go back and really make sure I was doing everything. But two, I mean, there's just no shame in writing more work down than you need. Okay, so here would be a C1, V1 again. I'm not gonna draw all the work. I'll just write the expression down, and I'll write the final result. Who owns the notebook? Ultimately it sort of depends on the context that you're in. If you're in a corporate setting, they're going to be very particular. They own the notebook, you do not. Maybe it's a little anorotentive, but I usually think that I'm the one who owns the notebook, even though I don't really own it. Ultimately, I think we would say the university owns it here. But, I'm the only one who's going to look at it other than you, right? Or maybe the next student coming in. And so in that sense, I feel a particular attachment to my students' notebooks to make sure that they're actually kept well and have the information in them that they need. But generally what you think that once you should be thinking is that generally you do not own a notebook. So it's not something where you can go home, take it home over the summer, keep it in your dorm room, it stays in the lab. Most likely, if some tragedy were to strike, suppose you were in a car accident, it's much more likely that you would disappear than that the building that you're working in would disappear, right? And so the likelihood that I could go home, get into a horrible car accident, my car explodes, and I'm blown into a million little bits is pretty small, but it's more likely than HandLab would be wiped off the face of the earth tomorrow, right? And so in that sense, if you have your lab notebook with you and there's some horrible tragedy that happens, and life goes on. We will mourn for you for a little bit, but ultimately we're going to get back to doing science again. We would like to be able to go pick up where you left off. You could think of that being sort of your longevity, or at least some of your longevity. You would have a paper published because you have data there that somebody else was able to pick up on your research project. And so generally, we want you to keep your lab notebook in the lab. Even for maybe equally tragic but less damaging things, if you keep it in your dorm room and somebody sets fire to the dorm, it's not like that hasn't happened. There have been dorm room fires even here at Mississippi State. We want you to keep the lab notebook safe, and generally the lab is sort of the safest place for it. Now, as we saw, you could be working on hydrogen in a compressed air tank. And the lab might not be a safe place all the time, but fortunately those are rare, and generally rarer than other types of accidents. So, but that said, in academic settings, now in a corporate setting, if you're working on like proprietary research, you probably can't do this either. And they generally will store their lab notebooks in a safe. One of my undergrad advisors used to work for Schlumberger, which is an oil company. He would have to basically sign his lab notebook every day, lock it in a safe overnight, and then he couldn't get it until the next day when the safe was open. But in most academic settings, if you want to make a photocopy of your lab notebook, you write 20 photocopies of your lab notebook, you can do that. It's not like, I feel like I have to have all the information, and particularly if you go on to a protein prep somewhere else and you want to look back at your notes, that's a perfectly valid reason. Now, if you want to go somewhere else to another lab and work on the exact same project that I'm working on, then we might need to have a conversation. But in general, it's fine to make photocopies of your lab notebook. How do you handle complex data? So this is a two-dimensional titration. I believe this is something I did when I was a postdoc. So where I was titrating drug into a particular molecule. And you can see that this is a large spectrum, and this isn't even the half of it. This is the finished final spectrum. The original spectrum is something like 15 megabytes of data. I'm not going to make a CD every time I collect nanomolar spectrum and paste that in. And so what I should generally do, or what I generally recommend students do, is have some kind of a typical printout. Ideally from the data that you're talking about now, but if you do this once, you probably don't have to do it 1,500 times. So have some kind of a printout, show what the important points are, this shift in residue 104 probably means that my drug is interacting with residue 104, and then take careful attention about where the original data can be found. NSF has very specific requirements about backing up and making sure that your data is archived properly. That's generally not going to be your responsibility, but you should be paying attention. I usually, you know, for the same reasons about, actually more so than the reasons for burning buildings or car accidents, I tell my students, you know, I don't want the primary location for your data to be stored on your laptop. Because again, laptops can get stolen, laptops break, but if they store it on my lab computer, I have it backed up every night for the past 5 years, all the way back to, you know, the first day that I started here, that, you know, I can access their data at any time during the last 5 years. If they change it, then I keep the old copy and the new copy replaces it, right? And so I have an archive backup of all of their data from the very first day that I started here. And again, if my computer crashes, I have it on redundant hard disks, and I have a third disk that's the backup drive as well. And so there's plenty of redundancy in my own lab system that if they copy their data onto my computers, I can be pretty confident that even if, you know, somebody were to come in with a flamethrower and take out my server, I'd still be able to get their data. If that happens to their laptop and that's the only place where they have their data, yeah, I'd be disappointed. I'd be probably pretty pissed. But you know, ultimately, it's not me that would be primarily affected, right? It'd be their research project that they'd either have to start over or, you know, find something else to do. And so from the point of your security, from the point of your advisor's, you know, research, you generally don't want to have the data on your laptop. That's not to say you can't keep a copy there. It's not to say you can't work on your laptop. But you want to have the primary storage site for your original data to be on some kind of system where there's appropriate backups and safeties installed. And then you note in your lab notebook where that is. The nice thing about lab notebooks is that they don't crash, unless you spill methanol on them. Okay, other types of, you know, what might that look like? You could say, you know, this chromatogram data is stored on FPLC PC, so this is a particular instrument, with the file name, so you give it the file name. I usually like to have my file name start with the date that the data was recorded. You could say, well, the operating system stores the date with the file. Yeah, but suppose somebody copies that to a new location, then it updates the date, and you've lost the date information. You know, I don't necessarily think it's the best to store it in the file name either, because the file name itself can be changed. You know, somebody could come along and rename that file, and you have no idea what it was. Personally, if I write my own code, I always make sure that that code has some value of the date, or it writes the date that the analysis was done in the output. But that's a side note, that's just, it's more sort of detail. But where it was stored, and then if you have an example, that's great, you can put it. But then also, you know, where were the details? Because clearly that data didn't just pop out of the earth. You presumably did some experiments to get that data out. And so, you know, if you have good page numbering, you can say, you know, the details for collecting this data were given on a particular page. And then, you know, I collected the fractions and the chromatogram is pasted up the right hand side. Or on page 66, or something like that. You know, this is plenty of information, and provided this computer is being backed up, and I'll tell you honestly, it was not at the time. This was when I was a postdoc. You know, then that computer crashes, I can always go back and regenerate this plot if I need to. This was for a protein prep, so I wasn't super concerned. But certainly all of my NMR spectra, all of my real hardcore data that goes in publication, yeah, that gets backed up. And at NIH, it's even, you know, this was when I was a postdoc, at NIH, it's even more hardcore. They have one of those, like, robots that puts the tapes in and out, and they have a big, giant storage system. It's pretty cool looking, but expensive, so your taxpayer dollars at work. Okay. Again, I'm trying to get us out of here. I think you can discuss this over coffee if you guys are going 9:29. So let's take a quick look though at my lab notebook. You can see, you know, where it's good. I'm not saying this is perfect. Does everybody have a printout of this? I think it's probably easier to have a printout than to have to look at it online. Well, you can look at it online too. The one thing I don't like about the printout is for some reason it stapled it in the wrong side. But here again, I mean, I think, you know, the lab notebooks I generally purchase for the lab, they aren't the cheapest lab notebooks that you can find, although I do work to find the best price. But I like having the grids. I also like having it so that the students don't have to number every single page individually. That just saves everybody time and effort. And so this was a collection of, basically, I started the protein, so we talked about protein expression. Just to think, you know, this is not just learn this information and bury it under a rock. That's exactly how we express most of the proteins in our lab. And so we grow up bacteria, we purify the protein out of the bacteria, and this lab notebook series basically characterizes how we do that. And so what I'm talking about here is I'm inoculating the cells, and I'm measuring the optical density at 600. And so again, there's not maybe enough information for somebody who's never done this before. You know, I'm not writing a detailed description, but certainly I can come back, anybody who has, you know, even a hint of experience in doing this kind of work will know exactly what I'm doing here. I'm saying, you know, I've corrected this with the dilution, so I've sort of wrote down how I'm handling the data. Because again, just like you can't measure absorbance above 1 accurately, you can't measure OD at 600 above 1. And so I have to dilute the sample out and then re-record the OD or calculate what the OD is. Now, one thing the grid lines do is make it a little hard to read the photocopy. Spun down cells, I wrote down what the OD was when I spun them down. We're not going to go through this level of detail here, but if I'm running a gel, you know, this is how I've labeled my gel lanes. You know, I note I don't have a picture of the gel yet. I just sort of outlined how I lay it out. I do record how many cells in terms of grams that I get. You know, if you write this number down and you say, okay, I had 2.8 grams of cells when I started and I ended up with 100 milligrams of protein, then you have an ability to sort of characterize from prep to prep how you're doing. If the next time you do it, you have 2.8 grams of cell and you end up with 50 milligrams of protein, well, and then you can go back and compare to your lab notebook and say, well, maybe something happened there. Maybe I need to be figuring out where my inefficiency was. Or was I really that efficient? And so if you do this, and you will do it, you know, particularly if you're making protein, you're going to do it 400, 500, 600 times, possibly in the course of a PhD, you know, you'll get a very good feeling for what kind of efficiency you expect, and you can monitor things if they're going, if it's starting to go south. You know, how did I set up the buffer for the loading die? Again, you can see I have in this case, this was a picture of the gel that I pasted in here. So this is, probably you can look to see tape, but this is a printout of the gel that I've taped in. I've labeled the markers, and again, in this case, there's uninduced, induced. So I've added IPTG to this sample, and so you can see that there's a big, bright band where my protein should be. And this is for a slightly larger protein, and then this is just a different series of concentrations. This is slightly more concentrated cells. So you can see these recombinant expression systems work quite well if you've not used them before. I have a list here where I basically have all of the information about these particular proteins. So if you look at this and you compare this to ProParam, you'll see that it looks very similar. I've edited the text file to make things a little bit more compact, but essentially what I did was I took the ProParam sequence and basically copied some of the results right there. And this is the result of a 6-frame translation from the biology workbench. And so, you know, I'm not just sort of throwing websites out that are hypothetically nice. I mean, I use these and I find them to be very helpful. But there's information here about the mass. There's information here about the number of carbons, et cetera, if I need to go calculate isotopic labeling. And I put some information, you know, I type in some information too. If I like lose the nickel or the hiss tag, you know, what, how does the mass change, etc. Not everything has to go in here, but certainly I have enough information that I can go back and regenerate it if I need to. We do a lot of column chromatography for purification, and so I have the information on how I ran my column. In this case, I was running a nickel column with 2 millimolar DTT, and I hadn't done that really ever, although I sort of remembered one of my colleagues doing it and having them comment that the column turned black. And so since that was kind of interesting and new for me, I just wrote it down. Column turned black with 2 millimolar DTT. Don't know if that's important, but may as well have it in there. So if I'm looking for things why the prep didn't work, maybe it had something to do with the column, I can go back and at least see that. In this case, everything did work. And so the column turning black was perfectly fine. Here's my chromatogram. I say, okay, I'm going to pull these fractions, A3 to A6, right where my protein peak is. I have a pasted printout of the chromatogram. In this case, I didn't write down where that was on what computer. Maybe I should have, so you can judge for yourself on that. You know, probably if it were the first time I was doing this, I probably would write it down. That would be a good idea. Nowadays, our FPLC systems are backed up, so we've addressed that. Okay, so here I do it again for the other protein. You can see here I'm calculating dialysis buffer. You know, I've done some calculations down here at the bottom for what concentration or what amount of protein I have. Again, another gel that I ran. So ran two gels. I don't run all the information for the gels because running gels is done enough that, again, probably you don't have to write that down. But if it's your first time or it's an early time, I recommend do write that down. You know, even though it was 5 years or so before I did a protein prep, you know, this was, I still remember how to run a gel. So I didn't write all that down. But if it's new to you, you know, take the 5 minutes, write out the protocol so you know what to do. You'll learn it better as you write it. You know, the reason I don't have to write it anymore is probably because I wrote it down the first 7 or 8 times I did it. Okay, now I'm not doing nickel NTA columns anymore, so I can really crank up the DTT concentration. You know, there's more preps, you know, more column stuff here. You know, here's where I calculated again the concentration of yield after each column. You know, here's my gels showing that, you know, what's what. Again, I don't have the markers written here, but I do have it. You know, I see page 46 for lanes, and if I go back to page 46, sure enough, there are my lane designations there. You know, this section, if you note, this was gel filtration, and I thought maybe things looked a little bit fishy. And so you'll see, I wrote some of that down. And in particular, through this and through some careful notation, I was able to determine that our gel filtration columns weren't working. So again, that's good to know. I mean, if you write down what you expect and note when something is different. Now again, in this case, it didn't affect the prep. The prep was perfectly fine, but we can't currently use our gel filtration columns to measure the resolution that we want. Nevertheless, you're still getting nice peaks out of it, so that's nice. And then now this last section, what we do is we run the mass spec so that we can actually say, you know, is this exactly the protein that we expect? And so here, since I've never really written this down in a notebook, I wrote a pretty detailed description of what the prep was for running mass spec. You guys are welcome to use this if you go back to your own institution, you want to run mass spec of a protein. I think this actually works pretty nicely. I do give some part numbers here, again, because I've just never written this in my notebook before. And then I have some, again, mass spec chromatograms. And then finally, the mass spectra itself. And I circle the comparison. So the expected molecular weight is 131.57, and the observed molecular weight from mass spec is 131.55. So, or 131.56 if you round up. So here again, I'm pretty confident that this is the right protein. It'd be pretty hard to make that combination of molecular weight work if it weren't exactly right. Similarly here, here's the mass spec data, here's the deconvoluted value, and the molecular weight is 18,578. Here, do I have it written down? Yes, 18,582. So, a little bit more different, but it's hard to imagine what atom would be for, unless it's picking up like a hydrogen atom or molecule, I guess. So it's close enough that I'm happy with it. And so you can see that there's a lot of information there. But it's something that I can go back, or if I have new students in the lab who've never prepared protein before, they can go and they can actually stand a chance of being able to do this themselves. Now they still might need some help, if they've never run a chromatogram or they don't know the specifics about running a machine. That's fine, we all need that. But, if there's any doubt about the protocol, they can really go and dig down and say, now he was using this concentration. And then he can go back and calculate, what was his yield here? What's my yield? Let's do some comparisons. Back in my graduate school days, it was a source of pride to be able to, make the most amount of protein for the given amount of cells. And so, the same friend who is now Dan Isom, who is now a faculty member at I believe medical school in Miami, he's actually quite successful now. So he was able to overcome this slip up of somebody else joining the lab and not paying careful attention. He just got a huge grant funded, so he's doing quite well. There's ways to recover from this, but he held the record for the most milligrams of staphylococcal nucleates per liter of cells in the lab. He still might hold that record. I think it was something like 220 or something ridiculous. He kept good notes. He had an impeccable lab technique, and I think ultimately it paid off for him in the end. So there's an example. You guys can take that home and use it as you like. Feel free to use it in your own demos. I'm not saying everything is perfect, but at least it gives you something to look at that sort of demonstrates how I think about keeping the lab open. Questions? Yeah?
What FPLC were you using, or what did you use to make this chromatogram right here?
So this is that was probably done on the ACTA FPLC. A 30-year-old.
We have an old ACTA FPLC that we don't use anymore, but the one that we use right now, like the spectrophotometer is just connected to if you've ever seen on TV when they have the people connected to a lie detector and the pen just writes.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, so we have like one of those and you have
pen plotter, yeah. Yeah, I've used one of those.
So I saw this and I was like, wow, this is so nice compared
pen plots. So probably you have the old HK system. So it's white and there's lots of bars and lots of tubes running around.
That sounds right.
Yeah. Is it an Amersham Pharmacia? Is that the manufacturer?
I don't know off the top of my head.
Okay. So those systems are even older.
Yeah.
And your only option there was the old pen plotter readout. The newer, so that ACTA FPLC was made in 1995 or 96. And they started selling them with a computer interface card that could be run by a program called Unicorn. And so that printout and the readout is now done on a computer. We can take you upstairs and show you what it looks like. I think I have to sign some papers upstairs anyway. It is quite nice. Although the very first system I cut my teeth on from ACTA, it was newer than what you guys were using, but it still had the pen plotter system hooked up to it. And so there's you know, it still had the functionality where it could be the old school pen plotter.
Yeah, and like with our HPLC, we can produce something kind of like this, but still not as useful as this.
Yes, no, it's very useful. I think the equipment that we have here, I've been very fortunate to have some really nice equipment to work with. And as you said, it's very diagnostic. If something looks fishy, you immediately can say, oh, look, that looks fishy. And then you can save it for later. And so it's quite nice. I really like those systems. The problem is they're discontinuing them. They're replacing them with their new and improved version, which is essentially, as far as I can tell, the same exact thing, but with different plastic around it. So, and then they charge you twice as much. So that's the way of scientific companies. But yeah, wait up, stick around for a few minutes, and then we can go up and take a look. I'll show you the active.
Maybe Dr. Schreiber will have another one we can take.